Blog Talk Radio.
From the deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, the SRI Label Group, Wildlife Educational Services, and Blog Talk Radio present Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover with us the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we discover his wild world.
Well, hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson. This is Blog Talk Radio and our weekly event we call Wild World with amazing guests. And always a pleasure to have you with us. Please send us emails to larry@larrytheanimalguy.com and tell us where you're listening to the show from. We'd love to hear that. We know we have listeners in England, New Zealand, Australia, and, of course, across the United States. It's very, very exciting. And as always, from his brand new Wild World new studio, completely renovated sound, knotty pine paneling. It also has a variety of tropical birds in that studio. The honorable, distinguished, and always courteous, Dr. Henry Day. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Why, good afternoon, Mr. Batson. We're quite excited about today's show. We've got an old friend on with us today, Harvey Kubernick.
No. And you know what the best smell in the world is, Dr. Day? Not a wet book. It's the smell of a new book. As I crack open, check out each page, the book, the story of the band from Big Pink to the Last Waltz is absolutely unbelievable. Harvey is a bookmaking machine. He has put out so many wonderful journals, and I know his legacy will be the greatest rock and roll historian we have. And this book is no exception. It's absolutely beautiful. I cannot see it. It's like a shopping mall. I don't see how you could see this all in just a few days. This just takes extensive reading. And the pictures, Dr. Day, and the layout, all very commendable. Of course, the writings of Harvey Kubernick are a good friend. And he's done books on the Beatles, Monterey Pop Festival, Laurel Canyon, Doors. Very cool. In fact, I didn't tell Harvey, I loaned that book of the Doors to probably one of the Doors' greatest fans here in Indiana. And he just went nuts. He said, man, this is absolutely fantastic. He said, I've never read or seen anything like this. So this band book of Dr. Day is no exception.
I'm excited.
Oh, you know what that means? That means also that we're going to be listening to some band music today, which is never a bad thing. So it's up
right
to go today. Henry Day and myself, whoever I am. Oh, here we go. Dr. Day, I was looking for the button. I just now found it. Are you ready?
I am.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Well, good afternoon. The African Grey is in the studio with me this afternoon, so you're liable to hear anything. So just bear with me during the Wild World News. All right, we're going to start out with some good news out of Norfolk, Virginia today. The U.S. Navy will expand areas off of the East Coast where it will limit the use of sonar and explosives to help protect the endangered North Atlantic right whales. Now, over the past few years, we know there's been a lot of problems with whales washing up on the shores, and they believe a lot of it has to do with the sonar.
Well, I can totally believe that, Dr. Day. I think that, you know, there's the sounds that the whales make, you know, singing, it's almost sonar-like, almost like that parrot you have in your suit. So, that's real. Dr. Day.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello. I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second.
Oh.
Probably like you say, it's probably the Taliban.
Yes,
all right, let's head off to Spokane, Washington. The six mountain caribou remaining in the lower 48 states will be relocated a little further north into Canada. Why are they doing this? Well, the Kalispell tribe in Washington State has been involved in a breeding project to try to expand the herd of mountain caribou. That's how rare they are. We hope them the best of luck with that project. All right, now we've got an Alfred Hitchcock movie going on in North Adams, Massachusetts. After everything else has failed, the National Guard is bringing in a cannon to scare away hundreds of crows that have been hanging around an electrical substation there in Massachusetts. Yeah, and as we know, murder of crows can be pretty scary. Now, do you know why the crow sat on a telephone line?
Because it's warm to their feet.
No, he wanted to make a long-distance call.
I should have known. I should have known. I am so angry with myself. Should have known.
I should have been expecting that. All right, to all of our listeners in Miami and the surrounding areas, it's that time of the year. The Florida wildlife officials are reminding boaters to slow down and watch out for the manatees. Why? Because they're on their annual trek into the warmer waters. So they will be on the move. Slow down and keep your eyes open.
Yeah, they're in shallow water usually because it's warmer. So that makes it easier for these boat propellers to chew them up. And it does. It does horrible injuries to them.
Yes. So please, slow down. Protect our manatees. All right, they're gathering different kinds of shells on the beach in Quincy, Massachusetts. Scientists say New England has seen an unusually early start to the turtle stranding season this year. Stranding, yes. With more than 40 turtles washing up on the Massachusetts beaches there already. Why is this happening? They don't know for sure.
We don't want our turtles stranded. No.
We do not. No. The only thing I can think of, what would, you know, unless the turtles were really buoyant and, you know, they couldn't stay under the water, which means they're not getting enough food. I don't know. But we'll keep our listeners advised of this situation.
Yeah, send your team out there and get this all solved and let us know. Get back to us.
Yeah, it's kind of an unusual thing. All right, they're going nuts in Town, Arizona. An annual survey shows the endangered Mount Graham red squirrel. They're making a recovery after a 2017 Fry fire that wreaked havoc on the animal's habitat.
Oh.
Burned all their nesting areas. Yeah, but they're starting to make a good recovery. So, kudos for the Graham red squirrels.
Yes.
All right, now out of Reno, Nevada, we've got a video of a moose roaming a hillside near Wells, the city of Wells there. Now, this reinforces what wildlife officials have suspected, that the animals are making a push into the Silver State. They've never really had moose in Nevada, and now they're starting to show up.
Well, isn't that something? I couldn't even imagine any habitat in Nevada that would be suitable for the moose.
That is true. Now, even though there was a video of the moose, there were no flying squirrels reported.
Jesus. You know, why do I have to put up with this every week?
Well, that's just one thing. You know, Harvey's got to sit through it too, so.
God help him.
All right, back to Miami, Florida. Fueled by bountiful swamps that provide a steady supply of marsh rabbits, deer, and other meals, the Burmese pythons, as we've reported on in the past in Florida, have rapidly adapted to becoming hardier and more resistant to cold. Yes, they're starting to get used to the cold, and now their Asian cousins, they don't do so well. They're not responding as well to the cold, which is good because we do not need any more unnative species in Florida.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. Very good, Dr. Day.
All right, Billings, Montana, the return of wolves and cougars to the Yellowstone National Park is helping to restore a landscape that has been altered in their absence. Yeah. So by bringing in the animals, we bring in all the nets. It's just a wonderful thing. So wolves and cougars are doing really good now.
Well, here's the thing. That ecosystem is so fragile. Now that the wolves have returned, here's one of the things that happened. There's a terrible overpopulation of elk. And the wolves will take care of a little bit of that. They'll help somewhat. They'll still have to feed them in the winter. But here's how the wolves are so important. They keep the elk herds moving. So the elk herds are not staying in one spot, literally eating the vegetation to the ground. They keep them on the move, keep them moving around. That's why it's so important. So then when they keep them moving, these mountain grasses and plants and flowers start growing, which attracts more birds, more songbirds. A lot of your different species of squirrels and chipmunks have moved back into Yellowstone that were not there, not because the wolves are gone, but also these other species that are native now to Yellowstone. So it's been a big win. Now, I will tell you, over the past, I've received a lot of negative comments because of I'm an advocate for wolves, and I think they're important to that part of the country. But to the rancher, they consider them their enemy. But there was one rancher that lived outside of Yellowstone. And you see, the government, if you can prove that a wolf has killed your livestock, they will reimburse you. Well, this fella just had a wolf call. And every time one would die from either lightning or natural causes, he'd take that wolf call, some blood, and leave these prints all over the animal's body. So then he could turn it into the government and get reimbursed for it. So, you know, we need wolves in Yellowstone. And believe me, when I talk to people in Canada that have had wolves longer than anybody, I asked them, are they ever concerned about their livestock? They said, no. They said, we lose more livestock to lightning and elements and that sort of thing than wolves. So I'm dead. I got off my soapbox.
That's okay. We needed that. Mm. And thank you for educating our listeners.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go to our zoos and see what's going on. Columbus, Ohio, the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium has acquired an addition to its polar bear family. Yes, Lee. Who has arrived there from the Denver Zoo. Also, Seattle, Washington, the Woodland Park Zoo will introduce two red panda cubs this coming Friday. So they have an outdoor exhibit. You can go view the two new red pandas. Also, in Yulee, Florida, four cheetah cubs are beginning to explore their habitat at the Wildlife Refuge in Northwest Florida. Two females and two male cubs were born October 6th at the White Oak Conservation in Yulee.
Cool.
So that's good news. Yes, good news for the zoos. Now, if you live in Milton, West Virginia, and you're seeing raccoons acting funny around town, don't be alarmed. They aren't rabid. They've just gotten drunk on crab apples. Yep, going on in a lot of places. As the crab apples come ripe, they get a little overripe. The animals eat them, and even your Uncle Fred will be out there, and you have to keep an eye on him. All right, you know what time it is?
Hey, Dr. Noble, before you go into that, I was kind of wondering about this crab apple thing and fermenting and the animals get intoxicated. I kind of was thinking, I wonder what Davies, the king, about that.
Have we got you, Dave? Listen, Dave.
Oh, I got you. I'm listening. Well, Larry, I don't know what to say about the current of the crab apples. We have things like crab apples here that you would have to eat a whole tree to get any kind of a buzz off of it. But good for all the animals. That saves them a lot of money, I bet.
Thanks, Dave. Your insight is always invaluable.
Thank you, Dave. Always check in. Listen to the show every time. Thanks, Dave. Well, it's time to play Who's Gotten Older. The good news today is we don't have that many celebrities, so you can't lose that bad, Mr. Batson.
And always, I'll be competing against our guest, which is the distinguished Harvey Kubernick.
Yeah, I think Harvey's going to do pretty good on this one.
All right, I'm ready.
All right, Who's Gotten Older? We're going to start out with Harvey's going to beat us on this one. Ellis Morales, jazz pianist. Ellis Morales, mm-hmm. Marsalis.
Hello. Go ahead.
What about him? New Orleans.
How old is he? He had a birthday on Wednesday, November 14th.
60.
Well, I have no clue, so I'll say 65.
Well,
oh, this is the father. I'm sorry. He must be 85.
This is the father.
Right. He must be at least 85.
Oh, I'll say 80.
Well, Harvey pulled this one out. He just turned 84.
Yeah.
Good job, Harvey.
Okay.
All right. One for Harvey.
I got confused when you mispronounced the last name. I thought it was comparing people. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
One up, Kubernick on the scoreboard. Okay.
All right. One to nothing. All right. Singer Stephen Bishop.
Okay. Stephen Bishop is 67.
God, I know he's probably right. I'll say 71.
No.
Wow. Well, Harvey hit it right on the nose. Stephen Bishop turned 67 on Wednesday.
All right.
2-0. All right. Pianist Yanni.
Interesting. 64.
I'll say 60. I have not a clue.
He is younger.
Wow.
Oh.
Harvey hit it right on the head again. He turned 67.
I knew I didn't have a chance in hell. Man.
Come on, you're talking you're caught to the winner and still champ.
That's right. All right, singer Neil Young.
Oh.
Neil Young is, let's see, if he was 70 in 2015, he is probably 70, I think he's 73.
Oh, I'll just say 75. I think Harvey's probably right. He wrote a book about it.
Well, yeah, Harvey got it right on the nose again.
I mean, I did do a book on him that came out in 2015 for his 70th birthday. I mean, I think I did the math correctly.
Yeah, I knew.
Yeah. All right, let's do one more. Guitarist Buck Dharma of Blue Oyster Cult.
Now, that's interesting, but I'm going to say that he is 69 years old.
I'll say 65.
Well, Buck actually turned 71 this past Monday.
Okay.
Oh, we got it. Oh.
So, Harvey, pretty much, he just beat you to death today. Yeah, really bad.
All right. Well, that means I get a longer interview to plug my new product. That's good.
Well, Harvey, since you won, you get to be on the show again.
I got nothing else to do on a sunny afternoon in Southern California.
All right. Well, let's do our fact of the day so we can bring Harvey out. All right, the riverine rabbit, also known as the Bushman rabbit or the Bushman hare, is one of the most endangered mammals in the world. with only around 500 living adults.
Oh,
well,
my God.
That is the Wild World News for November 18th.
Well, once again, a great job done by Dr. Day and his staff at the Wild World News headquarters in beautiful Indianapolis, now HD, and the beautiful Knotty Pine paneling just does wonders with the acoustics. We want to remind everyone also that our underwriter for Wild World every Sunday here on Blog Talk Radio is SRI Records. What an amazing catalog you can have the opportunity to download. I'm talking music from rock, blues, jazz, country. It's all there. Hall & Oates, Chambers Brothers. In fact, I was amazed they had a Herman's Hermit, a complete catalog of they made it better. I mean, it's so clear. And here's the thing, folks. You can listen to these songs singly, completely through. You don't have to buy them. You can, of course, buy them. We definitely do appreciate that. And their CEO, Shelley Leibowitz, who probably just might be one of the coolest guys you'll ever meet. And they're our underwriter here on Blog Talk Radio. Get back to Miss Fanny. Kubinakis, without a doubt, the premier historian of rock and roll. His books are amazing, from his look at the music culture of Laurel Canyon, a special journey he took us on to the Monterey Pop Festival, and an insight to America's most important band of the 60s, The Doors. The Genius of Leonard Cohen, the insight that Neil Young Harvey is a book-creating machine with an amazing onslaught of rock and roll music journals that literally captivates the reader and fan. This week on Wild World, we talked to Harvey about his latest new book, and maybe his best. We don't know. Brutal. The Band. Harvey Kubernick. Hi, Harvey.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
We're fantastic. How's Harvey?
I'm doing fine. It was really nice to hear The Weight by The Band, and I think we do this at least once or twice a year for what seems like the last decade, and really happy with this book. I really think a lot of new ground was forged, and a lot of revealing new information, you know, was brought to fruition. And this was a tough one to do. And, you know, when you do books on The Doors or Neil Young or Leonard Cohen, and this extends even to The Band, there's been previous books. These groups of musicians have been chronicled for 20, 30, 40, and 50 years. Of course, none of it stops me, because I wouldn't do this stuff if I didn't bring a ton of new stuff to the table. But I think the mindset of some people out there, and this is just some of the initial publishers I would bring this stuff up to, there was an initial feeling that what can you bring out that we don't know? And I think your reaction and the people digging this book, you thought you knew a lot about this group, but as you devour this book, I think it's like time release vitamin C, you just get staggered by what you keep getting exposed to, and I think I've rearranged your DNA with this one. Do you agree?
I would agree, and as I'm leafing through it, I will leaf through this book. I stop at certain points to read. That's what the beauty of this book is. You can leaf through it and enjoy beautiful photographs and these historical photographs, and then the little insights and stories and the different comments various people have said. This should be the Bible of the band for the historian of rock and roll music. This is absolutely, and I'm telling you right now, ladies and gentlemen around the world, this is a spectacular piece of literature. It's amazing. It just leaves me speechless. When I first opened up the box and they sent me a copy, Harvey did, I looked at the cover alone. I said, you know, this book is going to be badass. I could see by the cover. And when I opened it up, I was not let down. I was so impressed with it. So impressed.
Well, that's part of the rewards card, because, you know, people like you who have seen a lot of live music over the last 4 or 5 decades and seen a lot of what we now call classic rock in concert halls and big arenas in the Midwest, there's a West Coast slant to this book, but, you know, the band members moved out here. They recorded out here. I mean, one of the things that I'm proud of about the book is I chose to focus on the recordings, the studios, find the engineers, find the second engineers, find the assistants. And there's a little bit of a focus on the technology aspect of the band's recordings. And is even somebody like you who's at least, what's the word, learned about the history of the band, might have seen them on Ed Sullivan in 1969 or 70, might have bought the music from Big Pink album in the summer of 68. You didn't really know that portions of the Big Pink album were overdubbed and recorded in Hollywood at Capitol Records. You really had no idea that the band even went into the legendary Gold Star Studios in Hollywood and recorded some tracks. And I am not diminishing the rustic element of Woodstock and New York and the image portrayed by the band in graphics, iconology, album covers, photo sessions. But you had no idea there were recordings done out here and that Hollywood and L.A. played such a vital point that they went and did their second album in the hills of Hollywood in the pool room, in the pool house of Sammy Davis Jr. So what is so rustic about the East Coast in New York and Woodstock when you have the, shall we say, the elements of Southern California informing the recordings?
Well, and they didn't Hollywood them. That's what's the most impressive thing about them. That's why I've always thought that they recorded everything on the East Coast, the Big Pink House and whatnot. And I know, I think Rick Danko had a studio in his basement and a lot of this stuff, you know, but they went
Hollywood made such an impression by the end of 1973, all the band members started moving out to the West Coast in Malibu in anticipation of recording with Bob Dylan on Planet Waves and, of course, embarking on a late 1974 Dylan and the Band U.S. tour. So I think I bring some of the West Coast vision into this book, and it was a challenge finding the visuals and the pictures, and I had, you know, a team of editors and my brother working on this book, and just, you know, it was one of the first books where I would send some samples of my completed interviews to other people, and I got such great feedback from, like, real record business industry veterans. I mean, kind of like, you know, your relationship with Shelley Leibowitz. I mean, people that have been in the music business since the late 50s or through the 60s. And they told me, I didn't know this. I've never heard of this. Are you sure? And this kept on going on, and I realized, you know, when you read a book, and I'm talking strictly about, shall we say, music books, you'll learn two things, five things, or 10 or 15 little nuggets that will support some of your own theories of the journey, or somebody will remind you that somebody played bass on a session. But I think there's 100 of those moments in this book. But I also know one thing. The visuals and the pictures are so absorbing that I'm quite aware and not miffed at all that everybody's first exposure to the volume, they're just going to look at the book and the captions. And then in a week or a month or 6 months, they might actually read the whole thing because it's just too overwhelming, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. I mean, as I'm looking through this, I'm seeing names like Denny Bruce, Gene Aguilera, Don was, of course, an amazing record producer, and all these people involved with this band. And wouldn't you agree, Harvey, that I think of all the musical groups at that time, that other musicians respected the band more than any other of the other bands, if I'm being clear on that. Because I know Eric Clapton, he said there's one thing he would have loved to have done is to have joined the band and played with them, and which is amazing, especially hearing that from him.
And I think George Harrison and other people felt the same way because to some people, they were a breath of fresh air when they came on the scene, but they had been around and playing for so many years before then that they were really well-tuned by the time they made their first album. I remember hearing The Wait the first time, and I had an advantage over most of the people in the world regarding the band, simply that it's a regional reality. I'm living in West Hollywood. The band's record label, Capitol Records, is located in Hollywood, the principal office of the record label, which means teenagers like myself, thankfully, gratefully, got to hear either test pressings or advanced previews or promotional, you know, advance albums a few days or a couple of weeks before the rest of the world, simply because the main office, Capitol Records, is in Hollywood, is a mile away from West Hollywood. So, I hope I'm imparting the, if I want to call it an advantage, but the thing is, I was hit pretty hard by this stuff, and as I write in the introduction of the book, I ran into the singer-songwriter Jackie Duchannon in Laurel Canyon the summer of 68, and she demanded that I run over to Wallach's Music City on Sunset and Vine and get a copy of the Big Pink album. But in those days, and I'm sure you were in the same boat as me, to buy an album, well, that took 3 weeks to get the money, or to buy a single a week. And I think you know what we're talking about. Harvey Kubernick was not on any record company mailing list back then. So it took a lot of day job stuff to earn some money to go find the $4.99 or whatever it was. Right. And the record made such an impression on me, and a lot of my friends were musicians, and I had already seen a lot of live music in Hollywood. But I was really attracted to that first album. When I heard The Wait, I thought it was a song that Curtis Mayfield of The Impressions wrote, because it was churchy and it was biblical. And I remember hearing this word, you know, Moses in the lyrics on a first listening. And, and I'm in the middle of a world where the Doors are coming out, you know, with their third or fourth album, you know, The Soft Parade, and Love is blaring in late 67 with the Forever Changes album. And this was different than the psychedelic offerings that, you know, had been part of my environment. I never thought of writing a book on the group, but somehow this life has been presented to me that I never envisioned, partly because I never planned on it. The other part is so many people told me, you don't know anything about music or you can't write. And I think collectively they just turned me into the record geek I am, the record collector I am, the archivist that I am. But because I'm sort of in service to the music and I choose to do books that really veer away from all the dysfunctional, crazed loners and you know, drug use and the usual sad sack tales, I'm sort of getting this reward because I'm the guy that'll find the engineers or find the tape stock and kind of do little things that a lot of people don't think are important or don't think readers want. But I know that the readers want this stuff because they haven't read it in any other places.
No, and just like you just mentioned, one of the rules of when I talk to people coming on our show, I mean, we've had some pretty big, you know, Al Jardine from the Beach Boys, Dave Davies from the Kinks, Chris Frantz from Talking Heads, major artists, I think, members of the Rock and Roll. And I'll always tell them, I'm not interested in hearing about your negative sign, whether it be drug, alcohol abuse. All we want to talk about, and that's why I love the book so much, it's about the music and the creation of the music, the development of the music, how a song came from a simple demo or three chords and a guitar and playing it in the bathroom to the other members of the band, to these beautiful, lush recordings that we have now of the band. And I mean, and even though they went to LA to record these songs, they sound like they were recorded right in upstate New York. That's exactly the way I play that. So that's why.
Yeah.
They're not.
Is your phone okay?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
I was just closing out my comment. What do you think?
keep talking. I love to be worshipped. No, I'm just. I'm happy with this book. I'm really delighted it's reaching some people. It's out there on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. But, you know, these books become a bit more about me as well, simply because I'm the glue and the thread. And in
That's
the
right.
case of the band, there seemed to be some kind of maybe a bit of destiny involved in this group, only because, and I'm talking about this group and me as far as documenting them. When I went and saw the band do the last waltz in Thanksgiving of 1976, if you think I went there as some kind of careerist trying to cut a book and work the room and get a record business job, you're out of your mind. I scraped up the money to go get a ticket, which was only $25, but I knew I was going to get close to $40 if I reviewed it for a music paper called Melody Maker. And I figured, I could buy a ticket. We could go to see the group. We wouldn't have to go stay in a hotel. I was with three friends of mine. And I would net $15. Did I ever think that I would subsequently, interview band members? Although I had interviewed Robbie Robertson just before the last waltz in 1975 and went out to Shangri-La Studios. So I always made it a point to go to the studios to meet the engineers, to examine the tape stocks, to go into the vault, to want to ask about microphones. I know it may seem boring to some people, but I was in service to the music and the message and the signals being transferred. I made it a point in this band book. I don't think I talked to one girlfriend or one ex-wife. I don't do that stuff. Now, if you think I'm delinquent in telling the big picture, that's your decision. I'd rather talk to an engineer who told me about Rick Danko's bass setup. And one of the nice things about this book is I had a delightful friendship with a guy named William Schley, who served as the band's sort of equipment manager and head roadie from the day they went on tour. He kept copious notes and journals. He kept stage designs and graphics that are displayed in a book for the first time. That's really going to the source. And these things don't really show up in the few other books done on the band, and I think this might be the first book on the band, well, as far as the size of the volume and, of course, the color photos and my own pictures, as well as all the photography contacts I have, as well as bringing in a lot of new voices and people that have never been in books, coupled with voices and contributors that I know that you're aware of. But I think we really get a chance to visit the music of the band. I think I conveyed the excitement of their catalog. That's part of my gig. And, it's connecting, and I'm glad we're talking about it, because your listeners and viewers, whether it be Rick Derringer from way back or Dave Davies of the Kinks, there's musicality in your show coupled with, the Animal Kingdom. And, I'm just glad, you've seen the progress of my writing over the decade. And I actually think I'm getting better as a writer or as an alchemist or assembly person. I'm just really happy with this book, and it's the book that I'm getting the most, I don't know what you call them, little emails from friends of mine who are discovering the book in retail outlets, because it was just kind of announced without any fanfare. I think when you opened up that package, you didn't really know what you were getting, because it hadn't been touted and, shall we say, heralded. And when that thing opened up, you said, "What is this?" And I know the impact it has on people. I don't do this to have impact on people. I admit I like to educate and inform and put the light on a lot of new voices and remind people of the people that have been in the trenches. But I think when, somebody like you who remembers their debut album coming out, And you know, this is a book that really works, and I know it's going to be around for a while. And I'm just excited about it because it really took me 50 years to do this book. I mean, if I'm there in 1968, and I'm hearing this music in the late 60s and the 70s, and I'm seeing the band and Bob Dylan three times in 1974, and I'm interviewing Robbie Robertson in 75 and 76, and Rick Danko in 1978, and then Robbie Robertson again in 2016. This is a half a century window. You know, I just didn't jump on some Americana bandwagon. I am the bandwagon, you know? And it really did take 50 years to do, only because I have some references of 1967 and 1968 and setting up, you know, the exhibition. Let's just say, you know, if you start in 1968, the expedition is then set up. And the book does focus, you know, on a bit of the 50s and the 60s and the foundation work before we discover the group in summer of 68. And, you know, I know it makes impact, and that's part of the routing.
We're chatting with Harvey Kubernick and this exciting book, The Band. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Wild World on this magical network known as Blog Talk.
SRI Jazz is proud to present their newest release, This is Ray Brown Jr. That's right, Ella Fitzgerald's son continues to entertain audiences with his warm and charming vocals, making this one of the best vocal jazz albums of the year. Here are some sample tracks from the album. Visit our website to hear all of them in their entirety. Just go to srirecords.com or click on the banner in your media player now.
It's wonderful, marvelous. You should care for me. Awful nights, paradise, what I love to see. My baby, when she walks by, all the fellas go, I know why. Simply because that girl is so fine. If she'd ever leave me, I'd lose my mind. She's got the kind of loving, kissing and a hugging. Sure is mellow. Glad that I'm a fella, and I know, cause she knocked me off my feet. Have mercy on me. I know for certain, one I love. I'm through with flirting. It's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love. Oh, you must take the A-train to go to Sugar Hill, way up in all.
You've been listening to a few sample tracks from the new album, This is Ray Brown Jr. You can hear all the songs in their entirety at srirecords.com. Support jazz music today at srirecords.com. Consideration provided by SRI Jazz.
Hi, everyone. This is Shelley Newports. You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Wild Talk Radio.
And along with Dr. Henry Day, our guest Harvey Kubernick, and a great new book, The Band. We also remind everyone, SRI Records is our underwriter for Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Without them, we would not be on the air. What an incredible catalog they have. Rock, country, Jews, blues, jazz. I'll get it out. It's all fantastic right there on SRI Records. And guess what? You can listen to the tunes singly. You don't have to necessarily download them, but you can listen to them to their entirety on srirecords.com. We love us. Jim Michelle Lee.
Richmond had fell. It's a time I remember oh so
Kubnick, and Harvey, you were talking about attending the concerts when the band backed up Bob Dylan, and I'd always read that, oh my goodness, the band had to be so strong to survive that onslaught of booze and people that did not agree with the electrification of Bob Dylan.
Well, I think I document that in so many ways with witnesses in England, Australia, Canada, and of course, the United States in 1966 World Tour, when the band then known as the Hawks backed Bob Dylan. And then I have some really nice revealing comments from Robbie looking back, you know, decades later, how they really didn't do anything different. What we saw in 1974, although people were a bit older, nobody was booing in 1974 or hassling everybody with a lot of the same repertoire that was done in 1966. So once in a while you can say something or write something or predict something, and it'll be counterintuitive to what's really going on, but you know you're sort of right. And in this case, the band were right, sort of sticking to their guns and their musical policy. I mean, they might, along with Creedence Clearwater Revival and Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds, been, you know, very instrumental in, shall we say, creating this Americana radio format. And you still hear them on Little Steven's Outlaw Country Channel through Sirius XM and... you hear a couple of their tunes, you know, on satellite radio. I think what this book does, I think we put a little more heat and spotlight in some deep catalog cuts or selections that people might not be familiar with. But I also think there was a lot of side action with the band as far as members joining or temporary leaving and reuniting. And I think it's been pretty chronicled a little bit differently in this book as far as visual, augmentation. And also I have these witnesses that I like to bring in. I'm still sort of, strung out on the multi-narrative format. I like bringing in people to talk. I like giving them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 paragraphs instead of succumbing to our soundbite mentality out there. And I think people like you and the readers, I think you really like reading a page of somebody talking or a sidebar with 5 or 6 paragraphs where they just don't show up and give a quote and disappear. I think you get to know the people. And I think that's one of the, I don't know if it's an advantage, but I know that I'm certainly doing an oral history with a lot of text writing, you know, weaved with the photos and the visuals that as long as it's not like any other book out there, then I'm really happy.
Well, it's not. I'll guarantee that. Just think, though, what a variety of personalities were in that band. Rick and Levon and Garth, Robbie, Rick Danko, Richard Manuel. And when I looked at the part of the book on their concert schedule, their calendar that you
yes.
had, I thought to myself, how much work was it for a production manager or whoever was in charge of these tours to be able to get these five unique personalities on stage?
Well,
every...
let me just say something, and I'm delighted with this, shall we say, observation. Because in the front of the book in the acknowledgments, I list people as usual, but I did say third base coach William Schley.
Yeah.
And I gave him a third base coach credit. He is the band's roadie, equipment manager. He was there from Jump Street through a lot of it. And what I'm saying is, he kept such copious notes. The book was just about finished. And my editor in New York said, you know, it'd be kind of, I mean, this is a really good anecdote. And it really, I like to tell it to you because it really fortifies your question to me. And sometimes the best things show up when you think the game is over or you're in the 2 minute, you know, warning, or you're in the red zone. You know what I'm talking about. And the book was, I think, done. And my editor in New York said, you know, there's a website on the internet that has a lot of information about all the concerts that and appearances that the band did in their 1968 to 1976 physical existence. And I looked at it. And I went through a lot of tracking down to, because, you know, I do a lot of due diligence on this book as far as legal clearances and licensing work. I have to do all that. And I managed to track down this band website. Unfortunately, the person who put the website together had passed away a year ago, but somehow I found one of his sons in Sweden and asked and requested about displaying the work on the website. And we worked that all out. And I turned it in to my editor, but I also turned it in to William Schley simply because I thought he might have some visuals, whether it be backstage passes or laminates, you know, things that you see dotted in the book. And
sure.
He said to me, this is a really good list. There are a few things to correct, and I have every single date and every specific location. And it's how the internet works. There's a lot of good stuff on the internet. But unless you're in the band or driving the tour bus or setting up the equipment, do you really think you have every gig, or you don't have any of the fill-in shows sometimes, or the ones that have been rained out if it's an outdoor venue? And so as you look at the list of performances, which takes up pages, the original compiler, obviously, Tannenbaum, is thanked, and his kids are thanked and acknowledged, but William Schley filled in some other additional dates. And all of a sudden, it just, like when you ask me this question about the list, all of a sudden you have a book here that has every show to the, so specific, verified by somebody who was schlepping equipment and setting up wiring and at every rehearsal and sound check. And I don't think any other book has this information. So I'm delighted that it's one of the things that struck you, and it's at the end of the book.
Yeah, it is. I'll tell you what page here in a second. Oh yeah, here.
But didn't it make you perhaps maybe even more comprehend the contributions of the band and their legacy once you really took a look at their tour journal over the decade?
Well, they go through some, you know, they start out with Ronnie Hawkins. And
yes,
they're playing with him for the in the early 60s. And night after night after night. But what was happening, it was this group of musicians, they were becoming tough. I mean, the road was no big deal to them anymore. The whole idea of putting these performances together every night was a challenge to them. I really believe that it was a challenge. Sometimes they did extraordinarily, but I can tell, I think I know by reading the book and the personality they have, that maybe not every night was like, you know, a home run. Because to recapture that sound that they have on a night after night basis, especially not with the sound equipment we have now out,
right?
That was extraordinary. I mean, that would be very extraordinary for them to do that because their sound is so delicate. I mean, the band's now just turn it up loud, let the processors and the computer make this thing happen. That wasn't happening.
No.
And you
love. I mean, William Schley and later his brother John Schley, and as well as one other person, that was a very skeletal road crew. Different world then.
Yeah.
And you had some perfectionists in the band, as there should be. I don't know. It's a saga that I think has been captured on the page. I mean, I would hate to put things into winning and losing categories.
Mm-hmm.
But this book is a winner if somebody goes and buys a band album based on the book. If the book has propelled you to go into a record store or order an album online, strictly based on this book, we have a situation where a book has informed somebody to go check this group out. It's not about blogging and Facebook and Instagram and fan clubs and history and catalog. If somebody discovers the group from this book, I win. And if they don't go and buy the records because they have them all in the greatest hits and box sets and reissues already, they're reminded of the trip. So it's a win-win situation.
Who do you think was the backbone of the band? Which particular member do you think was strongest? Not necessarily if you listen to their sound, basically the
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's easy to say in the first part, it was kind of LeVon's, directive simply because you had a singing drummer and they got birthed out of LeVon and the Hawks.
Yeah.
Although Al Kooper tells me in the book that as the first album was being created, the engineer and producer, John Simon, would call Al at home because Al was in Blood, Sweat, and Tears at the time, and they had utilized the Columbia or A&R same studio in New York. And John Simon would say to Al Kooper, "Hey, you need to come down to the studio and hear Robbie's album."
Oh.
Robbie had a lot more of the songwriting credits, obviously. And songwriting is very key. And there was a vocal blend, and we're dealing with song arrangements and all that. It did become more of the Robbie experience later on. But that's merely on records. If you saw the group live, it was a situation where all five of them were equal. And sometimes Robbie, when he didn't solo, you would focus on Richard Manuel's voice or you would really key in on LeVon's drumming, but then you'd leave a concert and go, "My God, can Rick Danko play bass?" And then when you get to your car, you'd say, I can't believe how great Garth Hudson, the keyboardist, was tonight. You know, it's that kind of thing of like seeing a basketball team with a lot of scores on the floor. It, like in your case in Indiana, it wasn't all Reggie Miller all the time. There were other players on the team. But
yes.
Mark Jackson or whatever, you know what I'm talking about.
Sure, sure. Well, do you think that I think Garth Hudson's greatest contribution to the band was basically he filled all the holes. I mean, because every song, every note, you can hear the backlay of this magnificent keyboard work that he would do.
Yes, and there's a really good side part in the book under my brother's name, Kenneth, where he recounts an encounter with Garth on the 1974 Dylan tour. That's really good. And again, you know, you used to go to see rock and roll bands and you went to see the lead singer hit you. And then you kind of find out about the guitarist. And then you go, well, there's a bass player. Once in a while, there's a horn player you might dig. And then all of a sudden, you were really grooving on the piano player. But in the case of Garth, you realize this was a multi-instrumentalist. This was an accordion player. This was a guy with a Lowry organ on stage that was custom made. And the colors and the carnival of sound that he brought to the equation just, you know, can't be denied. And, you know, I remember talking to Jim Keltner. This is early, the drummer. This is as early as maybe 1970 or 71. I mention it in the book. I had just met him at a Mexican restaurant in Hollywood called Lucy's El Adobe Cafe in 1970, maybe, with a drummer friend, Bruce Gary, who you might know was in the Knack. And
oh,
Keltner
okay.
had just finished being with Delaney, Bonnie, and Friends and playing with Joe Cocker, Mad Dogs and Englishmen. And we went to the Mad Dogs and Englishmen concert in Santa Monica City, Civic Auditorium out in L.A. in 1970. And Keltner, just kind of matter-of-factly over some, you know, a barbecue beef tostada at Lucy's, said he had gone to a couple of recording sessions in 69 of the band's second album, which was done in Hollywood, because Carl Radel, who was in Derek and the Dominoes, and he played with Jim with Gary Lewis and the Playboys, and he was in, you know, Clapton's group, and even, I'm sure, in Mad Dogs and Englishmen. They were all friends. Carl knew LaVon from maybe Oklahoma or something, and Keltner went to a couple of sessions, including the night they drove O'Dixie down, and even went to a mixing session later in New York. But he said to me, Harv, you need to hear Big Pink on headphones. And remember, we're going into the late 60s, early 70s period. Headphones were very kind of new to people like us. You heard FM radio kind of shows up in 67. And then in 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, you started getting into your own stereo component system and headphones, by the way.
Sure.
And hearing Big Pink on headphones was just a marvel. The clarity, the depth, the sound of the drums, the multi-voice blend. And because it wasn't crazed psychedelic music and they were only getting into 8-track machines at the time. There weren't 16 or 24 tracks and 50 million overdubs. There was a clarity where you could really pick out the voices and the instrumentation. Made a big sonic impact on me. And not just me, everybody.
Oh, absolutely. I can remember that. Listen to Electric Ladyland on headphones in that time span, and the whole world changed dramatically. I mean, there's a lot of reports out there.
I can't tell you. I made it a point when I got my first pair of headphones. I played Electric Ladyland, Crosstown Traffic. And the panning aspect of Crosstown Traffic and the drum fills by Mitch Mitchell and the background vocals. And I don't think I went to homeroom the next day when I heard that, you know?
Yeah. My first album with headphones was Emerson, Lake & Palmer's The White Dove album, Take
yes.
a Pebble, Knife Edge.
Wow.
That was my first experience with headphones.
It made a difference. So the band kind of show up as FM radio is really entrenched stateside. It shows up at the tail end of 66. It really gets rocking a little bit in 67. But by 68, FM radio, freeform underground radio, as they called it, is really wailing. And AM radio stations and programmers and playlists had to make a bit of a concession to bring groups like the band onto the, you know, AM radio or the RKO radio chain syndication, you know, list of stations across the United States, the wider scope, you know, FM radio playlist. So timing is very key. Context is very important. You know, when I think of this book, it's not a book that talks about the band after The Last Waltz per se. There was a specific time period to examine it, which I was grateful. I didn't want to really get too much into talking about reissues and box sets and live albums that were issued. They're mentioned in the discography that I put together.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's really interesting to focus on kind of a group 68 to 76 with some history and foundation and backstory before then, because it's a very concise, condensed story. And I think that's one of the strengths of the book, but also one of the challenges to find the appropriate visuals and the photos. And again, you know, I made it a point to bring in some new voices that have never been published in books who had something to say. And, you know, there's also kind of an organic funk vibe putting this together. I did a bunch of phone interviews and got quotes from people, and then some later email interviews, and then some very specific in-person interviews that happened. So you get a blend of dialogue, conversation, impulse, observation, reflections. You know, it doesn't have a cookie-cutter mechanical aspect to it, I don't think. And I think that grabs you to continue to turn the page to go into the next thing.
Well, excuse me, I think one of the most important things about this book, and I just thought about this, Harvey, I really believe that in that time when the band and these other bands were so popular, they got so big with basically no really radio promotion whatsoever, very little television promotion, not unless you picked up a copy of the Rolling Stone or Melody Maker magazine. But I think it's what made this music explode was something we do not have anymore, and it's your everyday vinyl record shop, where you would go into these record shops and look through these vinyl albums, and many times the covers, the photography is what attracted you to that album. You turned it over, you read some of the song titles, what instruments were a part of it, and then that might make you buy the album. Then you take the album home and play it for other friends who also purchased the album. And I think if this was the album, the ball got rolling from something we don't even have now. Of course, they say, well, we've got the internet, but it's not the same. It is not the same. There was something about the experience, and God bless these groups like the band that put out these beautiful albums and covers, that when you went to a record shop to look for music to buy, you picked it up, you checked it out, and what was really great in some record shops, they'd actually let you play the album in these private listening groups. And that's why these bands, like the band and the other bands of the 60s, late 60s and so forth, that's why they became what they were. So amazing, extraordinary.
I would have to agree. The sense of discovery and word of mouth, they're not byproducts of video and television exposure. I mean, think about the band. They didn't even tour off Big Pink. They turned down lucrative offers for concerts. They waited till they had a second album ready, you know, before they went out, literally. You know what I mean? They didn't go book a tour the week after the Big Pink album was issued in retail. There's something to be said about those circumstances and why things happen, why they played their like debut concert in San Francisco and then ended the journey in San Francisco. There's a lot of metaphysical aspects that fuel this group. And do the songs work? Do the records hold up? Do you know how many people have covered The Weight? I mean, Aretha Franklin did it. And so, you know, you realize Robbie Robertson is principal songwriter, coupled with the equally talented, you know, and sanctioned, you know, messengers with him in the journey, really connected with people. And the other thing is, image-wise, you were confronted when you discovered the band with a bunch of guys who looked a lot older than what's being shilled on television now. Guys with beards. Oh, my God, they were, God, I think they're over age 22. They look like men as opposed to boys.
Yes.
And that's not to say they didn't have outrageous rock star lifestyles, including clothing and cars and all the things that come with that. But there was something a bit different. The perceived ruralness of it. But they could play their instruments, and they were multi-instrumentalists themselves. In fact, when I looked at the Big Pink album, I don't think they ever really told you who played what on the album or who the singer was. I don't think the instrumentation was truly defined. So there was, you had to really plug in, and until you read some interviews or saw them on Ed Sullivan, you didn't know who sang this stuff and what they really looked like. You might have seen a couple of photos of them, you know, and they played with Bob Dylan in 1968 at Carnegie Hall at a Woody Guthrie tribute concert. But it wasn't until way later, there was part of it was mystery, part of it was mystique. It isn't like today that you have to do Facebook and Instagram and all the other platforms to remind people of your existence. And so therefore, if you connected with the band or discovered them in a record shop or somebody in college in a dorm played it to you, that impression, like 100 other albums in your collection then and now, I think the foundation glue is that they were word of mouth, or you saw an ad in a newspaper, or you saw at a record shop displayed behind the counter. They weren't the byproduct of people beating you over the head, as well as 50 million people on the internet dialoguing about it, or good rapping it, or bad rapping it. The record review thing seemed almost secondary, and also the musicality was so riveting that where the Beatles and the Stones made you maybe join a band or pick up a guitar or buy a drum set, I don't know if the band did that as much, but it made you focus about songwriting.
Yes.
The creation of the tune.
Yes.
And I think, and as little Stephen Van Zandt and I have talked about this, and he says it in a documentary on, you know, about Link Ray, you know, Rumble, you know, the contributions of the Native American Indian to rock and pop music. And
sure.
He mentions, and it's in the book, Robbie Robertson might have really introduced a whole new form of songwriting when the band emerged. You know, it was just so personal and so, it was so steeped in something 1 or 2 or 5 or 800 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. James Cushing even talks about some of the work on Dylan and the Basement tapes that he thought they sounded like they were recorded on like wooden tape recorders or something. There was something ancient. There was an ancient aspect to the recordings and the lyrical vision. And, you know, I have a passage in the book where I talk about when the band emerged, they were, the music was focusing on some topics and themes where a lot of people were discarding some of those topics and themes. The band sort of really focused on them and reminded us or took us into some areas. And, you know, these are like 4 Canadians and a guy from Arkansas. you know, it's different. These aren't people from New York growing up there. They're not West Coast people. They're not byproducts truly of the South, but the combination of Southern soul and rock and pop and jazz and the classical vision of like, you know, Garth Hudson, the musical stew was so intense and so deep. You know, nobody sounded like them.
No, they didn't. No, they absolutely did not. Harvey, it's been absolutely fantastic. I want our listeners to know the story of the band from Big Pink to The Last Waltz. If you're a fan of the band, even if not, it doesn't matter. It's an extraordinary piece of work. What a great show, Dr. Day.
Never enough time when Harvey's on.
No, there's not. Harvey, we love you. We appreciate you coming on with us. We're going to finish up our amazing broadcast today with one of my favorite band songs from one of the newer albums.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. Check this out, Harvey. This is one of my favorites.
Well, they blew up the Chicken Man in Philly last night. They blew up his house, too. Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state. And the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble on the promenade. And the gambling commissioner's hanging on by the skin of his teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies, someday he comes back. Put your makeup on, get your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City. No honest.
Hi, everyone. This is Shelley Leibowitz. You're listening to my friend Larry Batson's Wild, Wild World on Wild Talk Radio.
Yeah.